And welcome to the summer 2023 edition of the course Personal Economics 2. My name is Nick Zubanov. I am a professor of organizational economics at the University of Constance. Probably some of you know me from the previous courses you may have taken with me, for example, Introduction to Organizational Economics and or Personal Economics 1. So you more or less know who I am, and if not yet, please check me out. I have a webpage on the University of Constance website. I've been working at the University of Constance since winter semester 2016, so quite some time already. And I've been teaching this course, Personal Economics 2, as part of the Personal Economics sequence of courses, starting from Personal 1 for all these years. So I look forward to yet another season of Personal Economics 2. And traditionally, this lecture, the first lecture of the course, is the introductory lecture where I explain what the course is about. I also present some organizational detail that I think is important to mention before we begin with the course itself. I will say a few words about the exam and what it takes to do well in the course. So because I'm not physically present in Constance at the moment, in fact, I'm in Canada visiting several colleagues in their universities who are working on joint research projects with them, this lecture unusually will have to be recorded and it will be placed on Ilya's course page very soon. So let's begin. Lecture number one, introduction and course details. So as I already mentioned, Personal Economics 2, the course that I'm beginning now, is part of the sequence of two courses, Personal Economics 1 and Personal Economics 2. Those of you who have taken Personal 1, you know a lot about Personal Economics already. Those of you who have not taken Personal 1, don't worry too much. Do worry a little bit, but don't worry too much, because I've tried my best to make the courses separate, even though related. So what this means is that you don't have to have studied Personal 1 to be able to pass Personal 2. Having said this, the two courses are related, if only by name, but of course they are related by more than name. Specifically, Personal Economics 1. In Personal 1, We studied the employment relationship as it unfolded chronologically from its inception till the end. So we began Personal 1 by talking about what happens at the beginning of the employment relationship. And in particular, we mentioned the issues of recruitment and selection. And we had quite a few lectures and tutorials on these issues, on these topics. We ended Personal 1 with two lectures on employee turnover. So the first lecture was more theoretical about employee turnover and its effects on organizational performance. The second lecture was more practical when we were talking about ways of managing employee turnover in organizations. So we looked at the employment relationship as a life story, as a biography. Right? So we started from the beginning and followed it up to the end of the employment relationship. Now, the idea of Personal 2 is different. In Personal 2, we will not adopt the same chronological approach to Personal Economics. In Personal 2, we will focus on one key issue in personnel management, in the management of human resources. And this key issue, the key issue in the management of human resources, is, of course, creating employee motivation, influencing employee motivation, hopefully in a positive way. Now, do I need to say why employee motivation needs to be managed? Well, if I do need to say about this, then my super short elevator talk about why employee motivation needs to be managed is because the interests of the firm and the interests of the worker are not one and the same. Workers want to maximize their income, which is their wage net of costs of effort. The firm wants to maximize its profit, which is sales net of the costs of operation, a significant portion of which is employment costs, is the wage costs. Clearly, these goals are not always compatible. The worker is better off working as little as possible, given the fixed wage, but the firm is clearly not better off with worker working as little as possible. The firm needs to make sure that the worker works hard and produces lots of output that the firm can then sell with a profit. So hence the problem of motivation. In Personnel One, we did study the problem of motivation in the framework called Principal Agent Framework. So I am going to assume that you know what the Principal Agent Framework is. If not, you can read about it in the lecture slides on Personnel Economics One, which are available on Elias. But in Personnel One, we limited ourselves on motivating employees through monetary means, motivating employees using cash, using compensation as the motivator. In this course, we are going to broaden this focus. We're going to broaden this focus by considering non-monetary aspects of motivation. So the course is not so much about cash, about paying for performance. This was the topic of Personnel One. This course is more about formal policies and informal relationships that exist within the workplace that encourage employees to deliver good performance. That is what the scope of this course, Personnel Economics 2, is. Now, let's look at the specific topics of the course and give it an overview. We will begin with the topic about authority and leadership. Now, why is studying authority and leadership as topics in Personnel Economics 2? Why is it useful? Why are these topics relevant? And why are these topics relevant for employee motivation? Now, of course, if you want to make employees work hard, you can try to command them into working hard. You can try to tell them that, look, you have to come to work at so and so and so. You have to work from the office rather than from home. You have to do this, but you should not do that. And if you disobey my orders and instructions, if you ignore my authority, then I'm going to unilaterally end the working relationship and you'll be out of the street, as it were. Right? So clearly, if you want to make workers work hard, you can exercise some authority. Of course, authority is limited. Organizations and their managers never have full authority over their employees, and for good reasons. The economics of authority is focal, is important to understand what firms can do to get their workers to work hard. A cousin of authority is leadership. Authority and leadership are obviously related. Both authoritarian managers and inspirational leaders have basically one task in common. They want to get the workers to do things that they want them to do. But the authority and leadership are clearly different from each other in that authority does not need to persuade people to do anything of their own accord. If you have sufficient authority, then it doesn't matter what the worker thinks or believes or considers to be the right thing to do. What matters is how much authority is whether you have the sufficient authority according to the employment contract to command the worker, to press the worker into doing what you'd like the worker to do. However, because authority is always limited, you cannot always command people. You cannot command people in every possible relevant aspect of work. Sometimes authority is not enough to get the worker to do the right thing. And then the leadership switches in. Leadership is, the difference between leadership and authority is that leaders do not need to coerce people into doing what they want them to do. Leadership is about persuading people to do what you want them to do. Now, we'll have a lecture on the economics of leadership as well, so stay tuned. Now, we will obviously consider the topic of monetary incentives. I did say that monetary incentives were studied mostly in personnel economics one, but not exclusively. We will have some material on monetary aspects of motivation, and in particular, we'll have a lecture on efficiency wages, career concerns, and extrinsic versus intrinsic motivation. So what is efficiency wage? Efficiency wage is essentially the wage that firms voluntarily pay to the workers that is above what they could in principle pay to the workers to get them to work for, right? So think about the wage that is higher than the market level, the wage that is higher than the minimum wage at which you could get the people with the right qualification to do work for you. Now, why would you need to pay more than the market rates? Isn't it wasting money? That's a very interesting question, and we're going to try to address it in this lecture on efficiency wages. And it turns out that paying wages that are above the market level has a motivational aspect to it. Put very, very simply, of course, we'll elaborate it, and it's much more interesting than that, but just the bare bones of the argument are that if you earn more than you could earn on the market, then you'd better make sure that your employment relationship continues on the terms that are better for you than the terms that you could face outside of the firm, right? So that creates a motivation to work hard, because if you do not work hard, if you shirk, if you put in low effort, then you're out, you're fired, you lose this job, you'll be pressed to leave the work, or you will be fired on formal grounds. And then the next job that you'll take will not be as good or as well paying as the job that you're having right now. So that creates a motivational, that creates a material motivation to work hard. And it seems to work, even though the efficiency of the efficiency wage differs depending on the context. In some situations, efficiency wage is a good idea. In others, it's less of a good idea. Now, so what is career concerns? We'll have a lecture on career concerns as well. Career concerns, well, it's the state of being concerned about one's career. So the term is pretty well defined linguistically already. But the economics of career concerns is, what is the motivational aspect of career concerns, right? So you are prepared to work hard today in order to get a better career and earn more tomorrow. So when we say career concerns, we talk about in so-called intertemporal motivation. We talk about the motivation for the worker to work hard today in return, not for the wage today, but in return for the higher wage, for a better job, for a higher ranking job tomorrow. Now, why do career concerns work? Career concerns work because the worker's performance is observed by the market. And observing the worker's performance, the market learns about the worker's ability. So having learned about the worker's ability, the market, the potential employers, will have updated their beliefs about how good or bad the worker is, and will offer them, the worker, will offer the wage that reflects the updated beliefs of the market about whether the worker is good or not. Give an example, right? So suppose you want to hire a random worker on the street. How much would you be willing to pay to him, right? So seriously, without consulting your HR office, without asking a C&D consultant to define the wage that would be okay to pay to this worker, what's the economic argument in determining the wage rate to a randomly chosen worker having formal qualifications, right? So in the absence of knowledge about how good or bad this worker is, your best guess is that this worker is average, right? So if you pay the worker the wage that reflects the average productivity of people who are demographically similar to him or her, and also similar in terms of qualifications, experience, and other observable characteristics, then I think you will you could do worse than paying this worker the wage that reflects some sort of average ability for this demographic group. But so having hired this worker, the worker receives the average market wage. Let's say the worker has higher ability, right? The worker is more productive and more talented than the average. How can the worker signal that he or she is more productive and talented than the average? Well, it's a variant of the signaling story that we studied in Personnel One. The signaling story we studied in Personnel One was a story about people signaling their ability by acquiring more education. Then firms see that, firms conclude that if people have more education, it means that they're smart because it's cheaper for them to study. In this case, in case of career concerns, if you are a high productivity individual, you work hard to demonstrate, to signal that you're a high productivity individual. The market will catch this signal and, you know, update its beliefs about how productive you are, right? So if you pay the worker the average wage, but the worker performs at the level that is very good, better than average, you observe it over some time, then you update your belief. You still don't know how good the worker is. You don't know it for sure, right? You get a signal, and this signal changes your beliefs about how good this worker is. You say, I thought this worker was average, but this worker is actually better than average. So in order to keep this worker, we have to increase his or her pay. So that's the essence of career concerns. And I think the incentive component of career concerns has already been demonstrated to you by this example. Basically, people have incentive to work hard because they're working hard today, will update the market's beliefs about how good they are, and tomorrow they will be rewarded with the wages that reflect their actual ability better than average. So we'll have a lecture on career concerns now. We will also have a lecture on extrinsic versus intrinsic motivation. That's when the monetary and non-monetary incentives really clash with each other. Typically, all sorts of motivation are used in the workplace, right? So far we used to think that, the workers are motivated using some sort of incentive pay. Or we used to think, the workers are not motivated using incentive pay. They're not motivated at all. There's some sort of signaling story going on, producing some sort of separating equilibrium that broadly defines workers into different groups, each of which receives a different wage reflecting the average productivity in that group. This kind of story. Reality is much richer than any theoretical model that seeks to describe it. So in reality, we are talking about a mixture of material incentives and incentives in the form of non-material aspects of work, right? So the material incentives in the language of psychology are called extrinsic motivation. So extrinsic motivation is the motivation using means that come extrinsically, that come outside of the person. Right? So monetary incentive is extrinsic motivation. But fortunately, some of us, at least, if not most of us, do what we do not only because we like to get money for doing what we do, but also because we kind of like what we do. I certainly do like my job, which is research and teaching. Well, maybe I like research more than teaching, but the whole package is very, very good. I do my job not only because I receive a very good wage for that, but also because I kind of like it. I like to do research. I like talking to students. I like trying to engage into intellectual discussions and learn something new in the process. So this liking to do what you do, making sense of doing what you do, refers to the so-called intrinsic motivation. It's the motivation to do the work that comes from within the person, or intrinsic. So we're going to look at both extrinsic and intrinsic motivation. We're going to consider situations in which intrinsic and extrinsic motivation reinforce each other in their positive effect on performance. But we will also look at the situations in which intrinsic and extrinsic motivation ruin each other, in which they compete with each other, and their total effect ends up being weaker than the effect of either intrinsic or extrinsic motivation alone. So super interesting lecture, a small excursion into psychology, but people from the previous years seem to like this lecture, according to the feedback that I heard. Now, so then we will move on to thinking about motivation coming from interactions that go on between people at work and the consequences of these interactions for performance. People are social animals. It is natural for us to exist in groups, for most of us, at least, right? So some of us are singletons and introverts, but even those need some company sometimes. Now, the world of work is also the world in which people work together in teams, either formally defined, we will have a lecture on teams, or informally defined, simply as a bunch of colleagues that see each other all the time. Right? They may or may not be formally defined as teams. So what you get in those teams, you can get some intrinsic motivation through, for example, recognition of your work by your peers. In many professions, it's very important. But you can also get information exchange. You can get feedback coming from your work colleagues that may affect your motivation and productivity as a result. In particular, we will have a lecture on, as I said, recognition and peer effects to make use of the feedback that comes from your workers, your colleagues, people around you. Now, recognition is purely intrinsic motivation. Peer effects may relate to both. It may affect both intrinsic as well as extrinsic motivation. So what is peer effects? Well, peer effects is the influence. Peer effects describe, it's a term, it's a collective term that describes all sorts of influences on the behavior of one person that come from the environment, come from the people, persons surrounding that person, right? So if everyone around you decides that it's okay to smoke in the lecture room, right? If everyone around you decides it's okay, then the likelihood of you deciding to smoke in the room statistically should go up, right? If everyone around you decides that it's okay to, if everyone around you or many people around you decide that it's not okay to drop litter on the streets, right? It's not okay to put your dirty feet on the passenger seat on buses and trains. And if everyone around you does this, then you'll be less likely to engage in the sorts of behaviors that would separate you from the rest of the crowd, right? So people do conform to social norms, and peer effects affect people's motivation, performance, and attitudes by providing them a comparison, providing them a reference with which they can assess their behavior and their action with respect to the local norm, to the norm that is local to the collective in which they work. So I mentioned the examples that I mentioned are behavioral examples, but there are peer effects on human behavior, but more relevant to this course are examples that are related to the world of work. And I will tell you a few examples illustrated by empirical studies, illustrated by actual real world data, showing that when people find themselves working among more productive individuals, they become more productive themselves. So peer effects, interesting lecture, and recognition. Now, we will also have lectures on teams and team incentives. I already mentioned the importance of teams in the world of work today. So however, the teams is an interesting object, right? So on the one hand, most of the work is done in teams today. So you cannot do a lot of work without having teammates, without managing teams, without providing motivation and incentives, encouragement, recognition, feedback, and managing peer effects that exist between people within a given team. But on the other hand, when you say teams, an economist would say free riding. So you probably have heard the term free riding in some of the courses that you take previously, be it microeconomics or my course Introduction to Organization Economics, where free riding was briefly mentioned in one of the lectures, the second part of it. What is free riding? Free riding is the failure of individual team members to provide the level of effort that would be efficient or first best. In other words, when you free ride, you provide less effort than the level that would have been most beneficial, not only to the team, but also to yourself. So free riding is bad, not only for the team, but also for the people who do free riding themselves. The question is, why do people free ride if free riding is bad for themselves? The answer to this question is Nash equilibrium. Free riding is unfortunately an equilibrium phenomenon. We're going to describe this using basic game theory in the beginning of the lecture on teams. But then, fortunately, we will consider that there are various solutions to free riding in teams. Free riding is theoretically a problem. It's also practically a problem. But the practice has come up with all sorts of ingenious solutions to counter free riding. You can think of hierarchies in teams. You can think of punishment institutions. You can think of non-random selection of people into teams, where people that are more similar in terms of attitudes, behaviors, views, are more likely to join the team with each other and teams that are more homogenous are less likely to free ride each other. So we'll look at these aspects in the lecture on teams. And last but not least, we will have lecture on team incentives. Super interesting lecture, a little bit technical. This course is a little bit technical as compared to personnel economics in general. But one of my favorite lectures, team incentives, we will study the empirics and theory behind team incentives, and we will compare the pros and cons. We will identify the pros and cons of individual versus team incentives, and ask ourselves a question: is it a good idea to mix individual and team incentives in one incentive package? As a spoiler, the answer to this question is probably no. And this answer defies many intuitions that people came with at the beginning of this team incentive lecture. So it was always good fun to challenge people and then try to convince them that their initial intuitions were not very strong, were not entirely correct. So that's the brief overview of the course. We focus on motivation. We will look at many instruments that have been used by organizations to change, to affect people's motivation in ways that is beneficial to organizations. So yeah, look forward to it. I look forward to it. Now here's the more detailed description of the course materials. So 3 lectures, 1 tutorial on authority and leadership, 3 lectures, 1 tutorial on incentives, 4 lectures, 1 tutorial on teams, and 3 lectures on social interactions at work. Then we will have a revision and questions and answers lecture, at least 1 lecture, and then optionally there will be a tutorial, but we will have to confirm this at the end of this course. We should have enough time, there should be enough interest, and if there is enough time and interest, then we'll have another tutorial where we could do a revision of the course, or, as has been a popular choice of people in the past, go through one of the last exams, one of the exams on the Personnel Economics 2 course that was offered in the past years when I taught this course. So that's the course content and structure. A few organizational details. please make sure that you locate the course webpage on Elias, and you please register there for the course. Elias, not Choice, is the platform that I use to communicate information about this course, Personnel Economics 2. All the course materials, including the video recording for this lecture and the script of the lectures that I'm using to accompany this video, are to be found on the course Elias webpage. All the announcements about the course will be made via Elias. For example, we may have to reschedule something on the course. We may have to reschedule a lecture or two on the course. And if we have to do that for whatever reason, then information about it will appear on Elias. So stay tuned and sign up for the course and register for the course using Elias. Who is the lecturer on this course? Who will be giving lectures on this course? Lectures on this course are given by me, Nick Zubanov. Here's my webpage. Please check it out. I like students to know me by name. I've trained my email program not to receive emails that do not have personal address. So for example, dear professor or hello or good evening, these emails will not be directed to me because there's been a lot of spam coming from fraudsters who don't exactly know your name. So I've had a few misfortunes there, and I've trained my email program not to receive these emails. So if you want to contact me by email, make sure you know my name, because otherwise you won't be able to contact me. So who is giving the tutorials? The tutorials will be given by me as well, right? So that's a little bit unusual. Usually bachelor courses are taught by professors on the lecture side and by teaching assistants on the tutorial side, but I don't have sufficient teaching assistants, sufficient teaching assistant resources to make it happen. This is an advanced course on the bachelor program, so people take it maybe as in their last semester on the bachelor program, and then they go and do various things. So it's hard to hire teaching assistants for this course. But if you do well on Personnel Economics 2, send me an email and express your interest in becoming a teaching assistant, and then we'll talk. Maybe you will end up teaching tutorials for me on this course for the rate of pay that the University of Constance pays to its teaching assistants. But for now, in this semester, I will be responsible for both lectures and tutorials. And I will also be the one who will grade your final exam on this course. Now, the course is organized in terms of lectures and tutorials, just like Personnel Economics 1. Just like Personnel Economics 1, course lectures will be video recorded, and course tutorials will not be video recorded. So only lectures will be video recorded, tutorials will not be video recorded. Now, the lectures, most of the lectures will take place in presence on campus of the University of Constance, but there are some exceptions. For example, this lecture, which is taught online because I'm not physically available at the University of Constance. But whatever happens, in whatever format the lecture is given, it will be video recorded so that you can watch it at a later point in preparation for the exam. Tutorials will also be given in presence unless there are circumstances that prevent me from being physically on campus, in which case tutorial will be given online. Now, when I say lectures and tutorials online, what do I mean? What's the Zoom link? The Zoom link to lectures and tutorials is provided on my webpage. So if you go to my webpage, you go summer term 2023, and where's the Zoom link? Okay, let's try to find the Zoom link. I have to instruct Mrs. Mundauf, my secretary, to update my webpage. Zoom link. There it is. There it is. So if you want to find the Zoom link, you just have to go to the previous semester, winter term 2022-23. Here's the Zoom link. You click it and it takes you to my personal Zoom channel through which online lectures and tutorials will be given. So course materials, just like Personnel Economics 1, there's no textbook. You don't have to buy any textbook. So I'm trying to save your money. The main course material is this lecture script that I'm using as a background for my lectures. So the lecture script has been uploaded to the webpage of the course. Make sure you locate it, make sure you download it. This is the main source of lecture materials for this course. This lecture, these lecture slides have lots of materials in them, but occasionally my lecture slides refer to scientific articles whose materials we will study in this course, whose materials we will use in this course. Now, some of these scientific articles, like for example, this one written by Philippe Aguillon and Jean Pirol, they are marked with this asterisk. That's called asterisk. Now, if an article is marked with an asterisk, what does it mean? It means that this is a compulsory reading. It means that reading this article is a must. You have to read this article. It's part of the course materials, and it is exam relevant, meaning that I can design exam questions based on the material of this article. Not all articles are compulsory reading, so there are some articles that are not marked with an asterisk. They're not compulsory reading. But when you see an article that is marked with an asterisk, it is compulsory reading, so make sure you download it and read it because it is exam relevant. It's a short introductory lecture. It's usually a little bit longer when I teach it in presence because there are some questions from students. But there we are. So we're doing it online. Therefore, the lecture is somewhat shorter than usual. Now, a few tips about what it takes to do well on this course. What are the prerequisites of the course? Now, the most important practical information that I can give you is that taking Personnel Economics 1 is not a prerequisite for this course. So if you have not taken Personnel 1, it's okay. Now, what are the prerequisites? The prerequisites are a good knowledge of microeconomics and econometrics at an undergraduate level. So if you are an economics student at the University of Constance, then you do have the right level of knowledge of microeconomics and econometrics. Well, I'm not sure about econometrics. It depends on when you've taken the course of econometrics, but I'll try to go easy on econometrics. It's in general a very good idea to educate yourself in econometrics because econometrics as the method of analyzing data has a lot of practical uses. And for your degree, for your economics degree, it's very important to be able to do something practically, to be able to develop not only knowledge and competencies, but also some practical skills. And data analysis is one of the few practical skills that economics education gives you. And fortunately, it is very highly valued practical skills. So make sure you learn your econometrics. A good knowledge of econometrics is very helpful for this course, Personnel Economics 2, as well. Now, I also already mentioned that Personnel Economics 2 course is technical, meaning that we'll be illustrating the theoretical concepts studied in this course using mathematical models. Not all. For example, the lecture on extrinsic versus intrinsic motivation is largely maths-free, but it's an exception. Most of the lectures in this course are maths-intensive. So if you want to fully understand the course and do well on the exam, you have to be good at maths. So what does it mean that you have to be good at maths? How good at maths do you have to be? Well, you don't have to be a math wunderkind, right? You shouldn't be a math professor, but you should have a good understanding and practical knowledge of high school maths, especially derivatives, Ableitung in German, integrals, and optimization problems. I'm talking about first order condition, and I'm talking about Kuhn-Tucker theorem. Right. So remember that maths is the language of economics, and a lot of economic concepts, not only for this course personnel too, but also for many, many other courses, are illustrated using the language of maths. So it's very important that you speak this language a little bit if you want to communicate effectively in economics. Now, as I said, personnel economics one is not a prerequisite, but if you have studied personnel economics one, it's going to be helpful, if anything, as a reference. So even if you have studied personnel one, that's good for you. If you have not studied personnel economics one, that's not a huge problem. But to those of you who have not studied personnel economics one, I would still recommend that you locate these lecture slides in personnel economics one on Elias. They are available, I believe. If you can't find them, send me an email, and I will send you the link to the lecture slides in personnel economics one. So I've spoken about personnel economics one, econometrics, micro, and maths. So these are the actual knowledge and skills that I count on in this course. Let's now talk about attitudes, behaviors, and soft skills that will be helpful for you in this course. Now, participation in lectures and tutorials. Be active. Well, for my impression generally is that undergraduate students are not super active. Many students don't come to lectures relying on video recordings of the lectures. Many students, when they do come to lectures, are not very active. They don't ask questions. They don't like me to ask questions of them. That's not the right attitude for someone who wants to develop a profound knowledge of any discipline, not only personnel economics too. So I would encourage you to be proactive. I would encourage you to ask questions. I would encourage you to participate in discussions. Personnel economics 2 may seem to be very theoretical and irrelevant to the real life, but this impression is wrong. Personnel economics 1 or 2 courses are super relevant to real life. They may not use the concepts and situations that you're most likely to encounter with to encounter in the real life, right? So there aren't a lot of people who solve optimization problems in the workplace, right? There aren't a lot of people who, when they decide on what to do and how to do, solve some sort of optimization problem and derive first order condition. That's true. But remember, we never said that workers in firms do maths. We said that the behavior of workers in firms can be described by mathematics, right? So that's two different things. The cases, the examples, the stories that we'll be telling as part of this course are super relevant, and they are very inviting for you to contribute, to participate, to agree, to disagree. I would even encourage you to disagree with what I say, and make your disagreement known, to have a great discussion, to have a nice, good debate in the lectures. And the same goes for tutorials, right? So let's not make our time together boring and uneventful. Let's make our time together interactive and fun, as much as circumstances allow. So an open and inquiring mind, curiosity, interest, motivation, passion are important. Now, this doesn't mean that not curious, unmotivated, impassionate people will not pass the course. No. What this does mean is that these attitudes towards learning are very helpful in your personal and academic development. So I would encourage you to develop these attitudes and apply them throughout the course. Now, a genuine interest in HR related issues is helpful. I think many of us can say it about themselves that we really hate doing what is not interesting for us, and we really do need a huge compensation for doing what is not interesting for us, right? So it's always better to like what you do. Fortunately, Personnel Economics 2 course is optional. It's not compulsory. Think about it. If you don't like it, don't do it. But if you want to do it, you'd better like what you do and be active and make the most of this course. So at the end of the course, there will be a written exam. Typical exam, typical for the University of Konstanz, lasting 90 minutes. It's a written assignment. It's not a take-home assignment. You'll be doing it in the exam room under the invigilation of myself and my assistants. The written exam accounts for 100% of the course grade. There are two attempts for this written exam, basically usual stuff, right? So very, very standard. Just for completeness, I've copied the usual recommendations, the usual tips I give to students to do well on the exam, right? So concentrate on the tasks in proportion to the number of points that these tasks offer. Maximize the amount of information per word. Don't write very long texts, write very informative texts. Make sure that you derive all the mathematical results presented in the lectures and tutorials. This is an excellent training for the exam, right? There's going to be a lot of questions on the exam asking you to derive this result or that result. The maths are simple, right? But without practice, even simple maths may be very difficult and time consuming. Notice that the exam is only 90 minutes. So to avoid running out of time and to maximize the number of points in the exam, the best practice you can do is derive the mathematical results presented in lectures and tutorials. Please take it seriously and try it. Do try it at home. Last but not least, since I am the one who will be grading the exam, I ask you to write legibly. I ask you to write in a way that other people could read what you've written. If your handwriting is as bad as mine, and mine is a very, very bad handwriting, write in block letters like I do. Okay, so if your handwriting is not legible, if I can't read what you've written, how can I give points for what you've done? So it is in your interest to make sure that what you're communicating to me by way of answering the exam question is not only academically sound, but also presented in a way that will allow me to understand what you've written. So with that, I'd like to finish this introductory lecture. It's recorded and will be placed on Ilias. Our next lecture will be about authority. Until then, all the best.